in June of 1924, 90 years ago, a rather extraordinary Englishman named George Mallory made his third attempt to climb to the summit of Mount Everest. We're going to get this. We really are. It's very dramatic. There's a picture of Mount Everest. It's amazing. Just start me at Mount Everest whenever you're ready. It's over 29,000 feet high. Is it there? Right? Did I tell you? To give you some idea of what an incredible feat that was, no one had done it by 1924, and no one ascended to the top of it again for another 30 years. They needed technology to catch up to the feat. When you walk outside tomorrow and you see an airplane, a little dot going across the sky, that's about 30,000 feet. That thing is barely higher from sea level than the mountain you see behind me. He had made two previous attempts, and 2 years earlier, he got very close to the top, within just a couple of thousand feet, when an avalanche took the life of seven Sherpas, servants who had gone with him. He was already world famous for almost making it. But in June of 1924, 37-year-old George, accompanied by a 22-year-old named Andrew Irving, left Base Camp 6 and a crew of guys behind and were seen ascending that last several hundred feet so that they could stand on top of the world. And what a moment that must have been. To literally be standing on top of the world. Talk about your mountaintop experience. He'd been working towards this goal his entire adult life. He had striven for it. No one had ever accomplished it before, and there he stood. And I have to tell you, from the moment that George Mallory and Andrew Irving stood at the top of that mountain, the rest of their life was set. They were going to be world famous. It would take them about a month to get back to London from this particular spot. And the news would beat them back. They're going to go back down to Base Camp 6. People are going to take pictures. They would be famous all over the world. He would be rich and set for life. He had just the day before written a letter to his wife and three kids about how, when I get home after accomplishing what I've always dreamed of doing, I'm just going to stay home with you guys and never go anywhere. His future was set. But those two men never made it home. Somewhere between this amazing mountaintop experience and getting back down just a couple of thousand feet to Base Camp 6, one or both of them took at least one misstep and they were tethered together and they disappeared into the abyss below them. In fact, they weren't found for 75 years. In 1999, they actually found the body of George Mallory at the bottom of a long ravine where he had fallen to his death. And as I was listening to this story just earlier this year, I was thinking about this amazing experience, like nothing else you'd ever done before. But he was famous for saying his whole life that the climb down is always the hardest. And I just wonder what he was thinking in those seconds before his death. Maybe something like this. The mountaintop experience only really matters if you make it home. Does that make sense to you? It really didn't matter unless you make it home and get to experience everything that goes along with it. And as I was considering this, it just so happened to be that while I was listening to this audiobook, I was also reading from 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And I want to invite everyone tonight to have your Bibles open to 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter. This will be the base text for all that we will discuss. We will move back into the Old Testament for a few stories, but we're coming back here. And I thought about Israel and their mountaintop experience, something that they had been striving for their entire lives. In fact, for 400 years, they'd yearned for nothing more than to stand on the other side, at the top of their own mountain, free. I'm talking about the story of the Exodus and the Red Sea. I'm sorry, I couldn't find any original photos. I really did look. The internet is an extraordinary place, but this rendition is all we have. I have to imagine that when they stood on the other side, free at last, having longed for it this long, that this must have been the most extraordinary, fulfilling, hopeful experience that they had ever had. They had just been baptized and had all of their past washed away. I'm in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Let me just begin in verse 1. For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They're home. They've arrived, or at least they've come to this point of freedom. Now, their future was set. You remember in Exodus 15, the song of Moses? Oh, they're celebrating. They're celebrating like they've never celebrated before. And now their future is perfectly cared for. God would take care of just about everything after this moment. In fact, verse 3 says, I will give you all the spiritual food that you need. Verse 4, God would give them all the spiritual drink that they needed. And in some way that I cannot explain, verse 4, even Christ was with them from this moment forward. But all they had to do from the moment of freedom, having sang the song in unison in joy, all they had to do was make it home. Home for them was Canaan's land. And unfortunately, what you're reading in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 is the reality that many of them, not just one or two, but many of them, somewhere from the mountaintop experience of freedom unto the land of milk and honey and protection, they took some misstep to the left or some misstep to the right, and they never saw this wonderful place that God had prepared. I'm in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and I'm looking in verse 5. Nevertheless, though free, though fed, though given that which they needed, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Why are they in 1 Corinthians chapter 10? I hope you understand tonight that we're not here to talk about some Englishman climbers to Mount Everest. But we're also not really here tonight to dig into the details of the choices that Israel made for Israel's sake. They're long gone. But their story is included in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 for an important purpose. They learned the same thing that those two climbers learned, that the mountaintop experience only really matters if you make it home. And now verse 6, the Apostle Paul said, these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved. We learn again in verse 11, these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. This lesson's not about 1924, and it's not about this many years ago when they crossed the Red Sea. It's about you, and it's about me, and that's the reason why Paul wrote it in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Do you remember your mountaintop experience? No one thought you could do it, but you did. The road to that moment of triumph and absolute exuberance seemed like you were never going to get there. But finally, one day, you put your foot up on top of that mountain. What am I talking about? If you need some help, I'm going to give you two helps. The first one is found two chapters later in chapter 12, 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 13. This is what Paul is really addressing here, the freedom that Christians have attained. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 13, he says, by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body. Jew, Greek, slave, free, it doesn't matter. We were all made to drink of the spiritual drink. We were all made to eat of the spiritual food. And Christ, the rock, would go with us. This is very similar to what we read in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Why is the Apostle Paul telling this story in chapter 10? Because as their moment of triumph came through baptism, so has ours. Do you remember that day? My daughter was immersed into a relationship with Jesus in February of this year. She probably remembers that very well. For me, it's a little further back than that. I don't remember anything else about that entire year. I was very young, except I could recall for you practically every detail of the night that I decided that I wanted to be freed from my sin and let those bonds go and celebrate what it meant to be in a relationship with Jesus. My story was memorable. My father told me to wait because he was working. He was a shift worker. And I told him that it was Wednesday night and I couldn't wait. And when I stood up to take my confession, my dad practically comes jogging in his Nomex outfit through the back doors to baptize me into Christ. We celebrated this together, much like they did. Do you remember yours? In a little while, we're going to end this lesson, and if there is anyone here who understands sin and knows that they have committed it, stop depriving yourself of this moment. There is nothing like knowing you are right with God. And this lesson is for those of us who have entered into a relationship with Jesus, but you know, the message is the same for you and me, right? The mountaintop experience of being baptized into a relationship with Jesus, it only really matters, right? If we get home. It was wonderful. There's lots of assurances, but I know too many people who have enjoyed the same song of Moses that you could read in Exodus 15, but they never made it home. Somewhere they stepped to the left or they stepped to the right. I just have to tell you tonight, and I guess I mean this in a couple of ways. Maybe it's why I'm ending the meeting with it. I don't know. I'm going home. I'm literally going home. Tomorrow morning we're flying home. I'm going home. I didn't muster up the courage to make that decision to put everything else out of my life and choose to stand up on top of the world with Jesus. God didn't invest spiritual food and spiritual water and the rule of Jesus in me so that I could just take some step off the left and find some crevasse to fall into where my soul will never be found. I'm going home, and I hope you are too. But if we're going to get there, we need to look at four things that are right there in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. The message is this: if you will see what derailed the Israelites, and we will learn to avoid those things, home is exactly where we're going, and we'll be there together. And the celebration that we enjoy in Christ never has to end. So just a few things. As I said at dinner tonight, I know the secret to maybe potentially almost possibly getting invited back, and it's to make sure you keep the last night's sermon kind of short. So I'm going to do that. No, I'm going to try to do that. I'm probably not going to do that. No, I'm going to do that. But I do need to take a moment, and you're probably thinking, it's the last night. Shouldn't he have said a bunch of sappy stuff about how much he loves us? I'm going to do that now. It has truly been a really great week. Hannah and I have never been to Brooksville, Florida before. We only knew two of you. Sharon and Jean have opened their home to us, opened the cottage to us. There was a bag of fishies, Gulf, and I ate the whole thing. I mean, just took care of everything we wanted the whole week. We had a lot of food, lots and lots of food. I did that little thing where you try on the same pants at the end of the week you tried on the beginning of the week. Don't ever do that. Don't ever, ever do that. But lots of good food, lots of fun. You know, that's part of it too, right? It's just kind of enjoying each other. Your weather has been unbelievable this week. We've been on some golf courses on the water. And then, of course, there's food and there's fun, but really it's about the fellowship. And I don't mean the fun food fellowship. I mean the Bible definition, where you really share in what it means to be a Christian. We've prayed together. We've sang songs together. We've studied the Bible together. We're building on something that I pray will never end. We're a family. We were a family before I got here, but now we're really a family that knows one another. And even after last night's sermon, 75% of you are social networking active, so find me, okay? Find me and friend me, and let's take the internet by storm by posting things that draw people to Jesus. I think we can do that, and I encourage you to do that. So lots we could say. I'll try to get to everybody individually when we're done, and we've done a little bit of that tonight. But, you know, Hannah, this is her first time to come on a meeting, and this was not good for her because it was too good. They don't always go that way. They're always okay, but this is really just has that family feel. I wish the best, and Mr. Vic and Miss LaDonna and 27-plus years of working here, and there are always going to be ups and downs that come with that kind of labor and those kind of years, but you want to talk about two people who love you guys and are committed to this work and the future of this work? 27 years, you don't see that. You don't see preachers and their wives that settle in, their wife, singular, that settle into a place because they have wives that get fired like they have, and I just... I see a bright future in what's coming. So that's that. But look, let's make it mean something, you know? I mean, what's the celebration? What's all the hugs we'll do tonight, the conversations we've had this week? If I come back through this way in 5 years and we have these somber conversations about these once faithful Christians who aren't worshiping anymore, these people who've just given up on the Lord, I'm tired of conversations like that, aren't you? I hate those kind of talks. I'd like us not to have those kind of conversations. I think maybe Paul has some things here he can share to help us with that. Four things we will examine and we'll be finished tonight. We'll base it in 1 Corinthians 10. We'll just reach back to the Old Testament to get little snippets of the actual story. But look in chapter 10. Our first verse we'll be examining is verse 7. You want to make it home? Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink, and they stood up to play. Now, I don't know how your Bible is put together in terms of the way the publisher bolds things or all caps or italicizes, but in my Bible, when it's a quote from the Old Testament, it's in all caps. So I can see here that the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play is a quote from the Old Testament. Do you know what he is referencing here? It's exactly what you're thinking that it is. This is that moment when they worship the golden calf all the way back in Exodus chapter 32. So let's keep our place here in 1 Corinthians 10, but I'm kind of intrigued as to what the apostle means when he says, Christians, if you want to get home from your baptism all the way to heaven, don't be idolaters like they were. So let's go back and take a closer look. I get all the way back to Exodus chapter 32, and I think we're probably somewhat familiar with the story, so I won't read all of that. But when we get back to verse 1, just to give the setting, look at verse 1. Exodus 32, 1. Now when people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said to him, Come make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Now I want to ask you a question here as we pursue this idea of idolatry. Just from verse 1, I'm not sure if you've thought about it from this perspective before, and if you disagree with me, I'm leaving tomorrow, so whatever. Verse 1. Is the golden calf being created to replace, I appreciate your prayer tonight, Yahweh. Was it being made to replace the Yahweh God, or was it being made to replace Moses? Now I want you to look at the verse again. Look at verse 1. They said, Come make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who you brought up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what has happened. So verse 4, he took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, Tomorrow shall be a feast to Yahweh. That is not a word they would have used of the golden calf. So he's saying, look, we have this idol we've built, but we're going to use it tomorrow as our means of worshiping the God of heaven. I am not convinced that they forgot about the Yahweh God just days after the mountain had quaked, after the thundering voice had descended, after the 10 plagues before it, the Red Sea, this great moment, and now they've just forgotten about Yahweh Creator God and they're replacing him? I'm not convinced of that. I think what they're doing is replacing Moses. I think they're saying, we still want to serve the Yahweh God of heaven. Look, we'll have a big party tomorrow and we will proclaim that honor, but we don't like the way. We don't like the way that it's been set up to worship the Yahweh God. You see, the way it's set up is we've got to sit down here like this for days, weeks, months, we don't know, and wait for Moses to come back. And then whatever he says goes. Let's come up with our way. You following me? Let's come up with our way to worship the Yahweh God. That is idolatry. You know, I think sometimes in our modern day, you know, when we teach about idolatry, we're talking about you're watching too much TV, or you're on the internet too much, and it's become your God, your idol. And I get that, but that's not what we're talking about tonight. That's not why he brought up this passage. I'm convinced what he's saying is they have found new, quicker, more convenient, more user-friendly ways of worshiping the Creator God. And God is not pleased with that, and anything of God you replace is considered idolatry. And because I'm reading it this way and have been doing so for a while, and you see verse 9, the Lord said to Moses, I've seen this people. Behold, they are an obstinate people. Let me alone. Let my anger burn, and I will destroy them and make a great nation. I think about this chapter. I preach at this church building on Dowland Road. There's lots of churches. And when I'm driving to the church building, I see this huge denominational church over here and then another one over here. And I used to see a big denominational church, but do you know what I see now? I see a golden calf in the parking lot. This is our way to worship God. We've created a way that works for us. We've created a way that's quicker. It's a shortcut. It's easy. People love it. Everybody gets to participate in it. It's still about Yahweh God, but we found this great way to do it. And it excites people, but it does not excite me. Because do you know what it is? It is idolatry. Folks, if we're going to make it home from here, there are no shortcuts. We can't get our heads together and decide that the way the Bible has designed for us to worship God is too difficult. It takes too much time. There's too much sacrifice. Let's build a new church building on the outskirts of town and put the word grace and community in it and let everybody come and we'll just do what works and we'll build it ourselves. We can't do that and get home. That's a misstep that causes lives. And in chapter 20 or chapter 32, when you get to verse 28, 3,000 men died right then and there. Exodus chapter 32 and verse 28. About 3,000 men of the people of Israel fell that day. Why did they die and not make it home? Because they weren't patient and committed to the plan that God had given. And so my encouragement as I leave tonight and head home, and I want it to be your encouragement to me, is if we're going to get home, it's always going to have to be God's way. And that means we keep reading our Bibles. How often do we read our Bibles? Every single day. Why? Because those calves can look awful enticing. And if I forget that it's God's way or no way at all, I have seen people leave the truth for a lie because the lie was faster, easier, more interesting, more fun, more catchy, and more people were doing it. Those people aren't going home. And they will fall in their error. I'm talking about the idolatry of replacing God's way with other ways. Let's get home, but we're going to have to stay in the book and stay with the pattern and find our security in that. Now go back to Exodus 32. Go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. That's where he begins. He says, don't be idolaters. Wait for that which has been given. Study it well. Follow it. Don't try to replace God's way with anything else. But then he mentions a second thing. He says, okay, not everybody was victim of that. There were some who were not involved. There were some who repented and they went right back to God's way and they followed Moses again. So now everybody's going to make it home, right? We've all decided, okay, we're not going to do that again. But instead, others of them didn't make it home. Do you know why? Go to our text in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 8. He said, nor let us act immorally, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. I think these are two of the largest obstacles for Christians to climb over or fight through that exist in our entire world around us. These obstacles that are stopping Christians in their tracks. The first one is the modern religious world and all the shiny cavalry of it. And the second thing is our society's selling of immoral behavior, the normalizing of physical and mental, lustful, immoral activity as if that's what everybody does and there's nothing you can do to stop it. God brought them through the water just like He brought you through the water. God raised them up and said, I will feed you, I will give you drink, and my son will be your rock, but you must not be immoral. You can't get home that way. Do you know where this story originates? You may have a marginal note. Verse 8 doesn't have any Old Testament quote, so you won't see it that way. But if your Bible has a little marginal note or something, it will tell you that this story about when they acted immorally actually comes from Numbers chapter 25. So let's take a couple of minutes and go back to Numbers 25, try to get a better idea of what they did wrong. Now, there was some idolatry involved there. They had given up on God's way again and started incorporating things that they had previously stood against. And you see that in the religious world, by the way. With idolatry comes a lax in morals because a lot of things start kind of piling through the gates. But here's what happened in Numbers chapter 25, verses 1 and 2. When Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. For they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. Now, when we move down a little bit further, we find that they were marrying in with these women whom they had no right to be with. They have joined with these daughters of Moab, verse 1, and they had no right to have that relationship. And so in verse 6, then behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman. in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation and took a spear in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and pierced both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through the body. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked. Those who died by the plague were 24,000. Now the two accounts work perfectly together. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, we learn that it wasn't just one Israelite and his unlawful sexual relationship, although it's not hard for you to get a mental picture of them being together in the tent and one spear piercing through both of their bodies. There's no surprise what they were doing. But there were 23,000 of them who died in one day. Ultimately, the text reveals that over the fullness of the plague, 24,000 died. Why didn't they make it home? Because somehow they started integrating with the culture a little bit here and there, being influenced by the people of Shittim around them. And here are physical relationships that are clearly forbidden, but they have chosen to step out in the name of their common culture and engage in immorality. And God said, "You will not be going home." We live in a culture where this needs to be discussed openly in families. We live in a time where you can't even watch the TV commercials between innings of the World Series without seeing what is being sold, what is being common. It is unnatural for us not to think about these things in the world in which we live. So we start believing that that's just the way it is. And I'm going to think about people I'm not supposed to think about. I'm going to wear clothes I'm not supposed to be wearing. I'm going to be in relationships that I'm not supposed to have. And let me tell you about this. There have been too many brethren. Brothers and sisters in Christ, I could make a list of 15 preachers if you wanted, who have stepped off of the pathway home in the name of the flesh's desire for immorality. Many, if not most of whom, have never returned again. Some of them, the bodies have, spiritually speaking, never been found. I want to be somebody who is so committed to going home. I didn't come through that water for nothing, and neither did you. I didn't start this journey so that something silly, something physical and carnal can lure my eyes and flesh and take me away from it and strip it from me. I want to be the kind of person so bent on going home. I